joyful, he mumbled to himself as he wrote. Excellent. Glockter carefully shut the lid on his horrible, beautiful instruments. I'm glad for both our sakes that we won't be needing these today. Frost snapped the manacles shut on the prisoner's wrists and dragged him to his feet, started to march him toward the door at the back of the room. What now? Shouted Ruse over his shoulder. Angland, Ruse, Angland. Don't forget to pack something warm. The door cracked shut behind him. Glockter looked at the list of names in his hands. Septan Teufel sat at the bottom. One name. On the face of it, just like the others. Teufel. Just one more name. But such a perilous one. Severard was waiting outside in the corridor, smiling as always. Shall I put the fat man in the canal? No, Severard. Put him in the next boat to Angland. You're in a merciful mood today, Inquisitor. Glockter snorted. Mercy would be the canal. That swine won't last 6 weeks in the north. Forget him. We have to arrest Septan Teufel tonight. Severard's eyebrows rose. Not the master of the mints. None other. On the express orders of His Eminence the Archlector. It seems he's been taking money from the Mercers. Oh, for shame. We'll leave as soon as it gets dark. Tell Frost to be ready. The thin practical nodded, his long hair swaying. Glockter turned and hobbled up the corridor, cane tapping on the grimy tiles, left leg burning. Why do I do this? He asked himself again. Why do I do this? Chapter 3. No Choice at All. Logan woke with a painful jolt. He was lying awkwardly, head twisted against something hard, knees drawn up towards his chest. He opened his eyes a bleary crack. It was dark, but there was a faint glow coming from somewhere, light through snow. Panic stabbed at him. He knew where he was now. He'd piled some snow in the entrance to the tiny cave to try and keep in the warmth, such as it was. It must have snowed while he was sleeping and sealed him in. If the fall had been a heavy one, that could be a lot of snow out there. Drifts deeper than a man was tall. He might never get out. He could have climbed all the way up out of the high valleys just to die in a hole in the rock, too cramped for him to even stretch out his legs. Logan twisted round in the narrow space as best he could, dug away at the snow with his numb hands, floundering at it, grappling with it, hacking through it, mouthing breathless curses to himself. Light spilled in suddenly, searing bright. He shoved the last of the snow out of the way and dragged himself through into the open air. The sky was a brilliant blue. The sun was blazing overhead. He turned his face towards it, closed his stinging eyes, and let the light wash over him. The air was painful cold in his throat, cutting cold. His mouth was dry as dust, his tongue a piece of wood badly carved. He scooped up snow and shoved it into his mouth. It melted, he swallowed. Cold. It made his head hurt. There was a graveyard stink coming from somewhere. Not just his own damp and sour sweat smell, though that was bad enough. It was the blanket, starting to rot. He had two pieces of it wrapped round his hands like mittens, tied round his wrists with twine, another round his head like a dirty, foul-smelling hood. His boots were stuffed tight with it. The rest was wrapped round and round his body under his coat. It smelled bad, but it had saved his life last night, and that was a good trade, to Logan's mind. It would stink a good deal more before he could afford to get rid of it. He floundered to his feet and stared about. A narrow valley, steep-sided and choked with snow. Three great peaks surrounded it, piles of dark grey stone and white snow against the blue sky. He knew them. Old friends, in fact. The only ones he had left. He was up in the high places, the roof of the world. He was safe. "Safe," he croaked to himself, but without much joy. Safe from food, certainly. Safe from warmth, without a doubt. Neither of those things would be troubling him up here. He'd escaped the Shankar, maybe, but this was a place for the dead, and if he stayed, he'd be joining them. He was brutal hungry as it was. His belly was a great painful hole that called to him with piercing cries. He fumbled in his pack for the last strip of meat. An old brown greasy thing like a dry twig. That would hardly fill the gap, but it was all he had. He tore at it with his teeth, tough as old boot leather, and choked it down with some snow. Logan shielded his eyes with his arm and looked northward down the valley, the way he'd come the day before. The ground dropped slowly away, snow and rock giving way to the pine-covered fells of the high valleys, trees giving way to a crinkled strip of grazing land, grassy hills giving way to the sea, a sparkling line on the far horizon. Home. The thought of it made Logan feel sick. Home. That was where his family was. His father, wise and strong, a good man, a good leader to his people. His wife, his children. They were a good family. They deserved a better son, a better husband, a better father. His friends were there too, old and new together. It would be good to see them all again. Very good. To speak to his father in the long hall, to play with his children, to sit with his wife by the river, to talk of tactics with Three Trees, to hunt with the dog man in the high valleys, crashing through the forest with a spear, laughing like a fool. Logan felt a sudden painful longing. He nearly choked on the pain of it. Trouble was, they were all dead. The hall was a ring of black splinters, the river a sewer. He'd never forget coming over the hill, seeing the burnt-out ruin in the valley below. Crawling through the ashes, fumbling for signs that someone got away, while the dog man pulled at his shoulder and told him to give it up. Nothing but corpses, rotted past knowing. He was done looking for signs. They were all dead as the Shankar could make them, and that was dead for sure. He spat in the snow, brown spit from the dry meat, dead and cold and rotted, or burned to ashes, gone back to the mud. Logan set his jaw and clenched his fists under the rotten shreds of blanket. He could go back to the ruins of the village by the sea just one last time. He could charge down with a fighting roar in his throat, the way he had done at Carleon when he'd lost a finger and won a reputation. He could put a few Shankar out of the world, split them like he'd split Sharma Heartless, shoulder to gut so his insides fell out. He could get vengeance for his father, his wife, his children, his friends. That would be a fitting end for the one they called the Bloody Nine, to die killing. That might be a song worth the singing. But at Carleon he'd been young and strong, and with his friends behind him. Now he was weak and hungry and alone as could be. He'd killed Sharma Heartless with a long sword, sharp as anything. He looked down at his knife. It might be a good one, but he'd get precious little vengeance with it. And who'd sing the song anyway? The Shankar had poor singing voices and worse imaginations, if they even recognized the stinking beggar in the blanket after they'd shot him full of arrows. Perhaps the vengeance could wait, at least until he had a bigger blade to work with. You have to be realistic, after all. South, then, and become a wanderer. There was always work for a man with his skills. Hard work, perhaps, and dark, but work all the same. There was an appeal in it, he had to admit, to have no one depending on him but himself, for his decisions to hold no importance, for no one's life or death to be in his hands. He had enemies in the South, that was a fact, but the Bloody Nine had dealt with enemies before. He spat again. Now that he had some spit, he thought he might make the most of it. It was about all he did have, spit, an old pot, and some stinking bits of blanket. Dead in the north or alive in the south. That was what it came down to, and that was no choice at all. You carry on. That's what he'd always done. That's the task that comes with surviving, whether you deserve to live or not. You remember the dead as best you can. You say some words for them. Then you carry on, and you hope for better. Logan took in a long, cold breath and blew it out.
Fare you well, my friends, he muttered. Fare you well.
Then he threw his pack over his shoulder, turned, and began to flounder through the deep snow. Downwards, southwards, out of the mountains. It was raining still, a soft rain that coated everything in cold dew, collected on the branches, on the leaves, on the needles, and dripped off in great fat drops that soaked through Logan's wet clothes and onto his wet skin. He squatted, still and silent, in the damp brush, water running down his face, the bright blade of his knife glistening with wet. He felt the great motion of the forest, and heard all its thousand sounds. The countless crawling of the insects, the blind scuttling of the moles, the timid rustling of the deer, the slow pulsing of the sap in the old tree trunks. Each thing alive in the forest was in search of its own kind of food, and he was the same. He let his mind settle on an animal close to him, moving cautiously through the woods to his right. Delicious. The forest grew silent, but for the endless dripping of water from the branches. The world shrank down to Logan and his next meal. When he reckoned it was close enough, he sprang forward and bore it down onto the wet ground. A young deer. It kicked and struggled, but he was strong and quick, and he stabbed his knife into its neck and chopped the throat out. Hot blood surged from the wound, spilled out across Logan's hands onto the wet earth. He picked up the carcass and slung it over his shoulders. That would be good in a stew, maybe with some mushrooms. Very good. Then once he'd eaten, he would ask the spirits for guidance. Their guidance was pretty useless, but the company would be welcome. When he reached his camp, it was close to sunset. It was a dwelling fit for a hero of Logan's stature. Two big sticks holding a load of damp branches over a hollow in the dirt. Still, it was halfway dry in there, and the rain had stopped. He would have a fire tonight. It was a long time since he'd had a treat like that. A fire, and all his own. Later, well fed and rested, Logan pressed a lump of chagger into his pipe. He'd found it growing a few days before at the base of a tree, big moist yellow discs of it. He'd broken off a good chunk for himself, but it hadn't dried out enough to smoke until today. Now he took a burning twig from the fire and stuck it in the bowl, puffing away hard until the fungus caught and began to burn, giving off its familiar earthy sweet smell. Logan coughed, blew out brown smoke, and stared into the shifting flames. His mind went back to other times and other campfires. The dog man was there, grinning, the light gleaming on his pointy teeth. Talduru was sitting opposite, big as a mountain, laughing like thunder. Fawley the weakest, too, with those nervous eyes darting around, always a little scared. Rudd Three Trees was there, and Harding Grimm, saying nothing. He never did say anything. That was why they called him Grimm. They were all there. Only they weren't. They were all dead, gone back to the mud. Logan tapped the pipe out into the fire and shoved it away. He had no taste for it now. His father had been right. He should never smoke alone. He unscrewed the cap of the battered flask, took a mouthful, and blew it out in a spray of tiny drops. A gout of flame went up into the cold air. Logan wiped his lips, savoring the hot, bitter taste. Then he sat back against the knotted trunk of a pine and waited. It was a while before they came. Three of them. They came silently from the dancing shadows among the trees and made slowly for the fire, taking shape as they moved into the light.
"Nine fingers," said the first. "Nine fingers,"
the second.
"Nine fingers,"
the third. Voices like the thousand sounds of the forest. "You're right welcome to my fire," said Logan. The spirit squatted and stared at him without expression. "Only three tonight." The one on the right spoke first.
"Every year fewer of us wake from the winter. We are all that remain. A few more winters will pass, and we will sleep also. There will be none of us left to answer your call."
Logan nodded sadly.
"Any news from the world?"
"We heard a man fell off a cliff, but washed up alive, then crossed the high places at the start of spring, wrapped in a rotten blanket. But we put no faith in such rumours."
"Very wise."
"Bethod has been making war,"
said the spirit in the centre. Logan frowned.
"Bethod is always making war. That's what he does."
"Yes, he has won so many fights now, with your help, he has given himself a golden hat."
"Shit on that bastard," said Logan, spitting into the fire. "What else?"
"North of the mountains, the Shankar run around and burn things. They love the fire,"
said the spirit in the centre.
"They do," said the one on the left. "Even more than your kind, Nine Fingers. They love and fear it."
The spirit leaned forwards.
"We heard there is a man seeking for you in the moors to the south. A powerful man,"
said the one in the centre.
"A Magus of the old time,"
the one on the left. Logan frowned. He'd heard of these magi. He met a sorcerer once, but he'd been easy to kill. No unnatural powers in particular, not that Logan had noticed. But a Magus was something else.
"We heard that the magi are wise and strong,"
said the spirit in the centre,
"and that such a one could take a man far and show him many things. But they are crafty too, and have their own purposes."
"What does he want?"
"Ask him."
Spirits cared little for the business of men. They were always weak on the details. Still, this was better than the usual talk about trees.
"What will you do, Nine Fingers?"
Logan considered a moment.
"I will go south and find this Magus, and ask him what he wants from me."
The spirits nodded. They didn't show whether they thought it was a good idea or bad. They didn't care.
"Farewell then, Nine Fingers,"
said the spirit on the right.
"Perhaps for the last time."
"I'll try to struggle on without you."
Logan's wit was wasted on them. They rose and moved away from the fire, fading gradually into the darkness. Soon they were gone, but Logan had to admit they had been more use than he dared to hope. They had given him a purpose. He would head south in the morning, head south and find this Magus. Who knew? He might be a good talker. Had to be better than being shot full of arrows for nothing, at least. Logan looked into the flames, nodding slowly to himself. He remembered other times and other campfires when he had not been alone. Chapter 4. Playing with Knives. It was a beautiful spring day in Adua, and the sun shone pleasantly through the branches of the aromatic cedar, casting a dappled shade on the players beneath. A pleasing breeze fluttered through the courtyard, so the cards were clutched tightly or weighted down with glasses or coins. Birds twittered from the trees, and the shears of a gardener clacked across from the far side of the lawn, making faint, agreeable echoes against the tall white buildings of the quadrangle. Whether or not the players found the large sum of money in the centre of the table pleasant depended, of course, on the cards they held. Captain Jezal Dan Luther certainly liked it. He had discovered an uncanny talent for the game since he gained his commission in the King's Own, a talent which he had used to win large sums of money from his comrades. He didn't really need the money, of course, coming from such a wealthy family, but it had allowed him to maintain an illusion of thrift while spending like a sailor. Whenever Jezal went home, his father bored everyone on the subject of his good fiscal planning and had rewarded him by buying his captaincy just 6 months ago. His brothers had not been happy. Yes, the money was certainly useful, and there's nothing half so amusing as humiliating one's closest friends. Jezal half sat, half lay back on his bench with one leg stretched out and allowed his eyes to wander over the other players. Major West had rocked his chair so far onto its back legs that he looked in imminent danger of tipping over entirely. He was holding his glass up to the sun, admiring the way that the light filtered through the amber spirit inside. He had a faint, mysterious smile, which seemed to say, "I am not a nobleman, and maybe your social inferior, but I won a contest and the king's favour on the battlefield, and that makes me the better man, so you children will damn well do as I say." He was out of this hand, though, and in Giselle's opinion, far too cautious with his money anyway. Lieutenant Casper was sitting forward, frowning and scratching his sandy beard, staring intently at his cards as though there were sums he didn't understand. He was a good-humoured young man, but an oaf of a card player, and was always most appreciative when Jezal bought him drinks with his own money. Still, he could well afford to lose it. His father was one of the biggest landowners in the Union. Jezal had often observed that the ever-so-slightly stupid will act more stupidly in clever company. Having lost the high ground already, they scramble eagerly for the position of likable idiot, stay out of arguments they will only lose, and can hence be everyone's friend. Casper's look of baffled concentration seemed to say, "I am not clever, but honest and likable, which is much more important. Cleverness is overrated. Oh, and I'm very, very rich, so everyone likes me regardless."
"I believe I'll stay with you," said Casper, and tossed a small stack of silver coins onto the table.
They broke and flashed in the sun with a cheerful jingle. Jezal absently added up the total in his head. A new uniform, perhaps? Casper always got a little quivery when he really held good cards, and he was not trembling now. To say that he was bluffing was to give him far too much credit. More likely, he was simply bored with sitting out. Jezal had no doubt that he would fold up like a cheap tent on the next round of betting. Lieutenant Jallenhorn scowled and tossed his cards onto the table.
"I've had nothing but shit today," he rumbled.
He sat back in his chair and hunched his brawny shoulders with a frown that said, "I am big and manly and have a quick temper, so I should be treated with respect by everyone." Respect was precisely what Jezal never gave him at the card table. A bad temper might be useful in a fight, but it's a liability where money is concerned. It was a shame his hand hadn't been a little better, or Jezal could have bullied him out of half his pay. Jallenhorn drained his glass and reached for the bottle. That just left Brint, the youngest and poorest of the group. He licked his lips with an expression at once careful and slightly desperate, an expression which seemed to say, "I am not young or poor. I can afford to lose this money. I am every bit as important as the rest of you." He had a lot of money today. Perhaps his allowance had just come in. Perhaps that was all he had to live on for the next couple of months. Jezal planned to take that money away from him and waste it all on women and drink. He had to stop himself giggling at the thought. He could giggle when he'd won the hand. Brint sat back and considered carefully. He might be some time making his decision, so Jezal took his pipe from the table. He lit it at the lamp provided especially for that purpose and blew ragged smoke rings up into the branches of the cedar. He wasn't half as good at smoking as he was at cards, unfortunately, and most of the rings were no more than ugly puffs of yellow-brown vapour. If he was being completely honest, he didn't really enjoy smoking. It made him feel a bit sick, but it was very fashionable and very expensive, and Giselle would be damned if he would miss out on something fashionable just because he didn't like it. Besides, his father had bought him a beautiful ivory pipe the last time he was in the city, and it looked very well on him. His brothers had not been happy about that either, come to think of it.
"I'm in," said Brint.
Giselle swung his legs off the bench.
"Then I raise you 100 marks or so."
He shoved his whole stack into the centre of the table. West sucked air through his teeth. A coin fell from the top of the pile, landed on its edge, and rolled along the wood. It dropped to the flags beneath with the unmistakable sound of falling money. The head of the gardener on the other side of the lawn snapped up instinctively before he returned to his clipping of the grass. Casper shoved his cards away as though they were burning his fingers and shook his head.
"Damn it, but I'm an oaf of a card player," he lamented,
and leaned back against the rough brown trunk of the tree. Giselle stared straight at Lieutenant Brint, a slight smile on his face, giving nothing away.
"He's bluffing," rumbled Jallanhorn. "Don't let him push you around, Brint."
"Don't do it, Lieutenant," said West, but Giselle knew he would. He had to look as if he could afford to lose. Brint didn't hesitate. He pushed all his own coins in with a careless flourish.
"That's 100, give or take."
Brint was trying his hardest to sound masterful in front of the older officers, but his voice had a charming note of hysteria.
"Good enough," said Giselle. "We're all friends here.
What do you have, Lieutenant?"
"I have earth."
Brint's eyes had a slightly feverish look to them as he showed his cards to the group. Giselle savoured the tense atmosphere. He frowned, shrugged, raised his eyebrows. He scratched his head thoughtfully. He watched Brint's expression change as he changed his own. Hope, despair, hope, despair. At length, Giselle spread his cards out on the table.
"Oh, look, I have sons again."
Brint's face was a picture. West gave a sigh and shook his head. Jallanhorn frowned.
"I was sure he was bluffing," he said.
"How does he do it?"
asked Casper, flicking a stray coin across the table. Giselle shrugged. "It's all about the players, and nothing about the cards." He began to scoop up the heap of silver while Brint looked on, teeth gritted, face pale. The money jingled into the bag with a pleasant sound. Pleasant to Giselle, anyway. A coin dropped from the table and fell next to Brint's boot.
"You couldn't fetch that for me, could you, Lieutenant?"
asked Giselle with a syrupy smile. Brint stood up quickly, knocking into the table and making the coins and glasses jump and rattle.
"I've things to do,"
he said in a thick voice, then shouldered roughly past Giselle, barging him against the trunk of the tree, and strode off toward the edge of the courtyard. He disappeared into the officers' quarters, head down.
"Did you see that?"
Giselle was becoming ever more indignant with each passing moment.
"Barging me like that, it's damn impolite. And me, his superior officer as well. I've a good mind to put him on report."
A chorus of disapproving sounds greeted this mention of reports.
"Well, he's a bad loser, is all."
Jallanhorn looked sternly out from beneath his brows.
"You shouldn't bite him so hard. He isn't rich. He can't afford to lose."
"Well, if he can't afford to lose, he shouldn't play," snapped Giselle, upset. "Who's the one told him I was bluffing? You should keep your big mouth shut."
"He's new here," said West. "He just wants to fit in. Weren't you new once?"
"What are you, my father?"
Giselle remembered being new with painful clarity, and the mention of it made him feel just a little ashamed. Casper waved his hand.
"I'll lend him some money, don't worry."
"He won't take it," said Jallanhorn.
"Well, that's his business."
Casper closed his eyes and turned his face up to the sun.
"Hot. Winter is truly over. Must be getting past midday.
Shit!
Shouted Giselle, starting up and gathering his things. The gardener paused in his trimming of the lawn and looked over at them.
Why didn't you say something, West?
What am I, your father?
Asked the major. Casper sniggered.
Late again, said Jallanhorm, blowing out his cheeks. The Lord Marshal will not be happy.
Giselle snatched up his fencing steels and ran for the far side of the lawn. Major West ambled after him.
Come on! Shouted Giselle.
I'm right behind you, Captain, he said. Right behind you.
Jab! Jab, Giselle! Jab! Jab!
Barked Lord Marshal Varouz, whacking him on the arm with his stick.
Ow!
Yelped Giselle and hefted the metal bar again.
I want to see that right arm moving, Captain, darting like a snake. I want to be blinded by the speed of those hands.
Giselle made a couple more clumsy lunges with the unwieldy lump of iron. It was utter torture. His fingers, his wrist, his forearm, his shoulder were burning with the effort. He was soaked to the skin with sweat. It flew from his face in big drops. Marshal Varouz flicked his feeble efforts away.
Now cut! Cut with the left!
Giselle swung the big smith's hammer at the old man's head with all the strength in his left arm. He could barely lift the damn thing on a good day. Marshal Varouz stepped effortlessly aside and whacked him in the face with the stick.
Yow!
Wailed Giselle as he stumbled back. He fumbled the hammer and it dropped on his foot.
Ah!
The iron bar clanged to the floor as he bent down to grab his screaming toes. He felt a stinging pain as Varouz whacked him across the arse, the sharp smack echoing across the courtyard, and he sprawled onto his face.
That's pitiful, shouted the old man. You are embarrassing me in front of Major West.
The major had rocked his chair back and was shaking with muffled laughter. Giselle stared at the marshal's immaculately polished boots, seeing no pressing need to get up.
Up, Captain Luther! Shouted Varouz. My time, at least, is valuable.
All right. All right.
Giselle clambered wearily to his feet and stood there swaying in the hot sun, panting for air, running with sweat. Varouz stepped close to him and sniffed at his breath.
Have you been drinking today already?
He demanded, his grey moustaches bristling.
And last night too, no doubt.
Giselle had no reply.
Well, damn you then. We have work to do, Captain Luther, and I cannot do it alone. 4 months until the contest. 4 months to make a master swordsman of you.
Varouz waited for a reply, but Giselle could not think of one. He was only really doing this to make his father happy. But somehow he didn't think that was what the old soldier wanted to hear, and he could do without being hit again.
Bah!
Varouz barked in Giselle's face and turned away, stick clenched tight behind him in both hands.
Marshal Ver...
Giselle began, but before he could finish, the old soldier span around and jabbed him right in the stomach.
Gah!
Said Giselle as he sank to his knees. Varouz stood over him.
You are going to go on a little run for me, Captain.
Uh-huh.
You are going to run from here to the Tower of Chains. You are going to run up the tower to the parapet. We will know when you have arrived, as the Major and I will be enjoying a relaxing game of squares on the roof.
He indicated the 6-story building behind him.
In plain view of the top of the tower. I will be able to see you with my eyeglass, so there will be no cheating this time.
And he whacked Giselle on the top of the head.
Ow!
Said Giselle, rubbing his scalp.
Having shown yourself on the roof, you will run back. You will run as fast as you can, and I know this to be true, because if you have not returned by the time we have finished our game, you will go again.
Giselle winced.
Major West is an excellent hand at squares. So it should take me 30 minutes to beat him. I suggest you begin at once.
Giselle lurched to his feet and jogged toward the archway at the far side of the courtyard, muttering curses.
You'll need to go faster than that, Captain,
Baru was called after him. Giselle's legs were blocks of lead, but he urged them on.
"Knees up!" shouted Major West cheerily.
Giselle clattered down the passageway, past a smirking porter sitting by the door, and out onto the broad avenue beyond. He jogged past the ivy-covered walls of the university, cursing the names of Varouz and West under his heaving breath. Then, by the near-windowless mass of the House of Questions, its heavy front gate sealed tight. He passed a few colourless clerks hurrying this way and that, but the Agriant was quiet at this time of the afternoon, and Giselle saw nobody of interest until he passed into the park. Three fashionable young ladies were sitting in the shade of a spreading willow by the lake, accompanied by an elderly chaperone. Giselle upped his pace immediately and replaced his tortured expression with a nonchalant smile.
"Ladies,"
he said as he flashed past. He heard them giggling to one another behind him and silently congratulated himself, but slowed to half the speed as soon as he was out of sight.
"Varouz be damned,"
he said to himself, nearly walking as he turned onto the Kingsway, but had to speed up again straight away. Crown Prince Ladislaw was not 20 strides off, holding forth to his enormous, brightly coloured retinue.
"Captain Luther!"
shouted His Highness, sunlight flashing off his outrageous golden buttons.
"Run for all you're worth! I have 1,000 marks on you to win the contest!"
Giselle had it on good authority that the prince had backed Bremerdan Gorst to the tune of 2,000 marks, but he still bowed as low as he possibly could while running. The prince's entourage of dandies cheered and shouted half-hearted encouragements at his receding back.
"Bloody idiots,"
hissed Giselle under his breath, but he would have loved to be one of them. He passed the huge stone effigies of 600 years of high kings on his right, the statues of their loyal retainers, slightly smaller, on his left. He nodded to the great Magus Baiath just before he turned into the square of marshals, but the wizard frowned back as disapprovingly as ever, the awe-inspiring effect only slightly diminished by a streak of white pigeon shit on his stony cheek. With the open council in session, the square was almost empty, and Giselle was able to amble over to the gate of the hall's marshal. A thick-set sergeant nodded to him as he passed through, and Giselle wondered whether he might be from his own company. The common soldiers all looked the same, after all. He ignored the man and ran on between the towering white buildings.
"Perfect," muttered Giselle.
Jallanhorm and Casper were sitting by the door to the Tower of Chains, smoking pipes and laughing. The bastards must have guessed that he'd be coming this way.
"For honour and glory!"
bellowed Casper, rattling his sword in its scabbard as Giselle ran by.
"Don't keep the Lord Marshal waiting!"
he shouted from behind, and Giselle heard the big man roaring with amusement.
"Bloody idiots!"
panted Giselle, shouldering open the heavy door, breath rasping as he started up the steep spiral staircase. It was one of the highest towers in the Agriant. There were 291 steps in all.
"Bloody steps!"
he cursed to himself. By the time he reached the 100th, his legs were burning and his chest was heaving. By the time he reached the 200th, he was a wreck. He walked the rest of the way, every footfall torture, and eventually burst out through a turret onto the roof and leaned on the parapet, blinking in the sudden brightness. To the south, the city was spread out below him, an endless carpet of white houses stretching all around the glittering bay. In the other direction, the view over the Agriant was even more impressive. A great confusion of magnificent buildings piled one upon the other, broken up by green lawns and great trees, circled by its wide moat and its towering wall, studded with 100 lofty towers. The Kingsway sliced straight through the centre toward the Lord's Round, its bronze dome shining in the sunlight. The tall spires of the university stood behind, and beyond them loomed the grim immensity of the House of the Maker, rearing high over all like a dark mountain, casting its long shadow across the buildings below. Giselle fancied that he saw the sun glint on Marshal Verruz's eyeglass in the distance. He cursed once again and made for the stairs. Giselle was immensely relieved when he finally made it to the roof and saw that there were still a few white pieces on the board. Marshal Verruz frowned up at him.
"You are very lucky. The Major has put up an exceptionally determined defense."
A smile broke West's features.
"You must somehow have earned his respect, even if you have yet to win mine."
Giselle bent over with his hands on his knees, blowing hard and dripping sweat onto the floor. Verruz took the long case from the table, walked over to Giselle and flipped it open.
"Show us your forms."
Giselle took the short steel in his left hand and the long in his right. They felt light as feathers after the heavy iron. Marshal Verruz backed away a step.
"Begin."
He snapped into the first form, right arm extended, left close to the body. The blades swished and weaved through the air, glittering in the afternoon sun, as Giselle moved from one familiar stance to the next with a practiced smoothness. At length he was finished, and he let the steels drop to his sides. Verruz nodded.
"The captain has fast hands, has he not?"
"Truly excellent," said Major West, smiling broadly.
"A damn sight better than ever I was."
The Lord Marshal was less impressed.
"Your knees are too far bent in the third form, and you must strive for more extension on the left arm in the fourth. But otherwise," he paused, "passable."
Giselle breathed a sigh of relief. That was high praise indeed.
"Ha!"
shouted the old man, striking him in the ribs with the end of the case. Giselle sank to the floor, hardly able to breathe.
"Your reflexes need work, though, Captain. You should always be ready. Always. If you have steels in your hands, you damn well keep them up." "Yes, sir," croaked Giselle. "And your stamina is a disgrace. You're blowing like a carp. I have it on good authority that Bremerdam Gorst runs 10 miles a day and barely shows a sweat."
Marshal Verruz leaned down over him.
"From now on, you will do the same. Oh, yes. A circuit of the Wall of the Agrient every morning at 6, followed by an hour of sparring with Major West, who has been kind enough to agree to act as your partner. I am confident that he will point up all the little weaknesses in your technique."
Giselle winced and rubbed his aching ribs.
"As for the carousing, I want an end to it. I am all for revelry in its proper place, but there will be time for celebration after the contest, providing you have worked hard enough to win. Until then, clean living is what we need. Do you understand me, Captain Luther?"
He leaned down further, pronouncing every word with great care.
"Clean living, Captain."
"Yes, Marshal Verruz," mumbled Giselle.
6 hours later, he was drunker than shit. Laughing like a lunatic, he plunged out into the street, head spinning. The cold air slapped him hard in the face. The mean little buildings weaved and swayed. The ill-lit road tipped like a sinking ship. Giselle wrestled manfully with the urge to vomit, took a swaggering step out into the street, turned to face the door. Smeary bright light and loud sounds of laughter and shouting washed out at him. A ragged shape flew from the tavern and struck him in the chest. Giselle grappled with it desperately, then fell. He hit the ground with a bone-jarring crash. The world was dark for a moment. Then he found himself squashed into the dirt with Casper on top of him.
"Damn it!"
he gurgled, tongue thick and clumsy in his mouth. He shoved the giggling lieutenant away with his elbow, rolled over and lurched up, stumbling about as the streets seesawed around him. Casper lay on his back in the dirt, choking with laughter, reeking of cheap booze and sour smoke. Giselle made a lame attempt to brush the dirt from his uniform. There was a big wet patch on his chest that smelled of beer.
"Damn it,"
he mumbled again. When had that happened? He became aware of some shouting on the other side of the road. Two men grappling in a doorway. Giselle squinted hard, strained against the gloom. A big man had hold of some well-dressed fellow and seemed to be tying his hands behind his back. Now he was forcing some kind of bag over his head. Giselle blinked in disbelief. It was far from a reputable area, but this seemed somewhat strong. The door of the tavern banged open, and Weston Jallanhorm came out, deep in drunken conversation, something about someone's sister. Bright light cut across the street and illuminated the two struggling men starkly. The big one was dressed all in black, with a mask over the lower part of his face. He had white hair, white eyebrows, skin white as milk. Giselle stared at the white devil across the road, and he glared back with narrowed pink eyes.
Help!
It was the fellow with the bag on his head, his voice shrill with fear.
Help! I am...
The white man dealt him a savage blow in the midriff, and he folded up with a sigh.
You there!
Shouted West. Jallanhorm was already rushing across the street.
What?
Said Casper, propped up on his elbows in the road. Giselle's mind was full of mud, but his feet seemed to be following Jallanhorm, so he stumbled along with them, feeling very sick. West came behind him. The white ghost started up and turned to stand between them and his prisoner. Another man moved briskly out of the shadows, tall and thin, dressed all in black and masked, but with long, greasy hair. He held up a gloved hand.
Gentlemen!
His whining commoner's voice was muffled by his mask.
Gentlemen, please. We're on the king's business.
The king conducts his business in the daytime, growled Jallanhorm.
The new arrival's mask twitched slightly as he smiled.
That's why he needs us for the night-time stuff, eh, friend?
Who is this man? West was pointing at the fellow with the bag on his head. The prisoner was struggling up again.
I am Septim... Oof!
The white monster silenced him with a heavy fist in the face, knocking him limp into the road. Jallanhorm put a hand on the hilt of his sword, jaw clenching, and the white ghost loomed forward with a terrible speed. Close up, he was even more massive, alien, and terrifying. Jallanhorm took an involuntary step back, stumbled on the rutted surface of the road, and pitched onto his back with a crash. Giselle's head was thumping.
Back!
Bellowed West. His sword whipped out of its scabbard with a faint ringing. Hissed the monster, fists clenched like two big white rocks.
Ah!
Gurgled the man with the bag on his head. Giselle's heart was in his mouth. He looked at the thin man. The thin man's eyes smiled back. How could anyone smile at a time like this? Giselle was surprised to see that he had a long, ugly knife in his hand. Where did that come from? He fumbled drunkenly for his sword.
Major West!
Came a voice from the shadows down the street. Giselle paused, uncertain, steel halfway out. Jallanhorm scrambled to his feet, the back of his uniform crusted with mud, pulled out his own sword. The pale monster stared at them unblinking, not retreating a finger's breadth.
Major West!
Came the voice again, accompanied now by a clicking, scraping sound. West's face had turned pale. A figure emerged from the shadows, limping badly, cane tapping on the dirt. His broad-brimmed hat obscured the upper part of his face, but his mouth was twisted into a strange smile. Giselle noticed with a sudden wave of nausea that his four front teeth were missing. He shuffled towards them, ignoring all the naked steel, and offered his free hand to West. The major slowly sheathed his sword, took the hand, and shook it limply.
Colonel Glockter?
He asked in a husky voice.
Your humble servant, though I am no longer an army man. I'm with the King's Inquisition now.
He reached up slowly and removed his hat. His face was deathly pale, deeply lined, close-cropped hair scattered with grey. His eyes stared out feverish bright from deep, dark rings, the left one noticeably narrower than the right, pink-rimmed and glistening wet. "And these are my assistants, Practical Severard," the lanky one gave a mockery of a bow, "and Frost." The white monster jerked the prisoner to his feet with one hand.
"Hold on," said Jallanhorm, stepping forward, but the Inquisitor put a gentle hand on his arm.
"This man is a prisoner of His Majesty's Inquisition, Lieutenant Jallanhorm." The big man paused, surprised to be called by name. "I realize your motives are of the best, but he is a criminal, a traitor. I have a warrant for him, signed by Archlector Salt himself. He is most unworthy of your assistance, believe me."
Jallanhorm frowned and stared balefully at Practical Frost. The pale devil looked terrified, about as terrified as a stone. He hauled the prisoner over his shoulder without apparent effort and turned up the street. The one called Severard smiled with his eyes, sheathed his knife, bowed again, and followed his companion, whistling tunelessly as he sauntered off. The Inquisitor's left eyelid began to flutter, and tears rolled down his pale cheek. He wiped it carefully on the back of his hand.
"Please forgive me. Honestly, it's coming to something when a man can't control his own eyes, eh? Damn weeping jelly. Sometimes I think I should just have it out and make do with a patch."
Giselle's stomach roiled.
"How long has it been, West? 7 years? 8?
A muscle was working on the side of the Major's head.
9. Imagine that. 9 years. Can you believe it? It seems like only yesterday. It was on the ridge, wasn't it, where we parted?"
"On the ridge, yes."
"Don't worry, West. I don't blame you in the least."
Glockter slapped the Major warmly on the arm.
"Not for that, anyway.
You tried to talk me out of it, I remember. I had time enough to think about it in Gurkle, after all. Lots of time to think. You were always a good friend to me. And now, young Colum West, a major in the King's Own. Imagine that." Giselle had not the slightest idea what they were talking about. He wanted only to be sick, then go to bed. Inquisitor Glockter turned toward him with a smile, displaying once again the hideous gap in his teeth.
"And this must be Captain Luthar, for whom everyone has such high hopes in the coming contest. Marshal Verruz is a hard master, is he not?"
He waved his cane weakly at Giselle.
"Jab, jab, eh, Captain? Jab, jab."
Giselle felt his bile rising. He coughed and looked down at his feet, willing the world to remain motionless. The Inquisitor looked around expectantly at each of them in turn. West looked pale, Jallanhorm mud-stained and sulky. Casper was still sitting in the road. None of them had anything to say. Glockter cleared his throat.
"Well, duty calls."
He bowed stiffly.
"But I hope to see you all again, very soon."
Giselle found himself hoping he never saw the man again.
"Perhaps we might fence again sometime," muttered Major West.
Glockter gave a good-natured laugh.
"Oh, I would enjoy that, West, but I find that I'm ever so slightly crippled these days. If you're after a fight, I'm sure that Practical Frost could oblige you."
He looked over at Jallanhorm.
"But I must warn you, he doesn't fight like a gentleman. I wish you all a pleasant evening."
He placed his hat back on his head, then turned slowly and shuffled off down the dingy street. The three officers watched him limp away in an interminable, awkward silence. Casper finally stumbled over.
"What was all that about?" he asked.
"Nothing," said West through gritted teeth. "Best we forget it ever happened."
Chapter 5. Teeth and Fingers.
"Time is short. We must work quickly."
Glockter nodded to Severard, and he smiled and pulled the bag off Septan Teufel's head. The master of the mints was a strong, noble-looking man.
His face was already starting to bruise.
"What is the meaning of this?"
he roared, all bluster and bravado.
"Do you know who I am?"
Glockter snorted.
"Of course we know who you are. Do you think we're in the habit of snatching people from the streets at random?"
"I am the master of the royal mints,"
yelled the prisoner, struggling at his bonds. Practical Frost looked on impassively, arms folded. The irons were already glowing orange in the brazier.
"How dare you!"
"We cannot have these constant interruptions," shouted Glockter.
Frost kicked Teufel savagely in the shin, and he yelped with pain.
"How can our prisoner sign his paper of confession if his hands are tied? Please release him."
Teufel stared suspiciously around as the albino untied his wrists. Then he saw the cleaver. The polished blade shone mirror-bright in the harsh lamplight.
"Truly a thing of beauty. You'd like to have that, wouldn't you, Teufel? I bet you'd like to cut my head off with it."
Glockter almost hoped that he would. His right hand seemed to be reaching for it, but he used it to shove the paper of confession away instead.
"Ah," said Glockter, "the master of the mints is a right-handed gentleman."
"A right-handed gentleman,"
Severard hissed in the prisoner's ear. Teufel was staring across the table through narrowed eyes.
"I know you. Glockter, isn't it? The one who was captured in Gurkle, the one they tortured. Sanden Glockter, am I right? Well, you're in over your head this time, I can tell you. Right in over your head, when High Justice Marovia hears about this."
Glockter sprang to his feet, his chair screeching on the tiles. His left leg was agony, but he ignored it.
"Look at this,"
he hissed, then opened his mouth wide, giving the horrified prisoner a good look at his teeth. Or what's left of them.
"You see that? You see? Where they cracked out the teeth above, they left them below. And where they took them out below, they left them above, all the way to the back. See?"
Glockter pulled his cheeks back with his fingers so Teufel could get a better view.
"They did it with a tiny chisel. A little bit each day. It took months."
Glockter sat down stiffly, then smiled wide.
"What excellent work, eh? The irony of it, to leave you half your teeth, but not a one of 'em any use. I have soup most days."
The master of the mint swallowed hard. Glockter could see a drop of sweat running down his neck.
"And the teeth were just the beginning. I have to piss sitting down like a woman, you know. I'm 35 years old, and I need help getting out of bed."
He leaned back again and stretched out his leg with a wince.
"Every day is its own little hell for me. Every day. So tell me, can you seriously believe that anything you might say could scare me?"
Glockter studied his prisoner, taking his time.
No longer half so sure of himself. "Confess," he whispered. "Then we can ship you off to Angland and still get some sleep tonight."
Teufel's face had turned almost as pale as Practical Frost's, but he said nothing. "The Archlector will be here soon, already on his way, most likely. If there is no confession when he arrives, we'll all be off to Angland, at best." Glockter took hold of his cane and got to his feet.
"I like to think of myself as an artist, but artistry takes time, and we have wasted half the evening searching for you in every brothel in the city. Thankfully, Practical Frost has a keen nose and an excellent sense of direction. He can sniff out a rat in a shithouse."
"A rat in a shithouse," echoed Severard, eyes glittering bright in the orange glow from the brazier. "We are on a tight schedule, so let me be blunt. You will confess to me within 10 minutes.
Teufel snorted and folded his arms.
Never!
Hold him.
Frost seized the prisoner from behind and folded him in a vice-like grip, pinning his right arm to his